Okay, over to you.
Okay, hello everyone. We're sort of treading water here till we get a few more folks. There is at this point four of you. So, if anybody has any questions about anything about the Ageless Wisdom, I'll do my best to answer. If not, that's just an open invitation until we get a few more people. And since I do this part of it for the pretty much for the recording, so that people know how to find recordings, I'll go ahead with that. So this is our 72nd webinar on sacred teachings of all ages. And of course, this webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. Previous episodes of this Secret Doctrine and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search, Francis Donald, and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of Moria Federation. There's a little list in the upper left-hand corner which provides live links that'll take you right into. So if you think something might be going on, and you didn't get an invitation or you can't find your invitation, you can always go here and check it out. Make sure. Also, the Mori Federation calendar, which is right here, is a great way to both check what's available and also to join, because each of those calendar entries also provide a link into the webinar. Okay, we get a few more folks, so I'll go ahead and start. We're heading into the final pages of this chapter, entitled The Bimbene Table of Isis, also known as the Mensa Isiaka. Last time, we began by taking a look at how the ancient Chaldeans structured their four-tiered universe, which they called spheres of being. This is relevant because the same four spheres of being are illustrated in the, as it's shown here, are illustrated in the Mensa Isiaka. So you have the archetypal sphere, which is the realm of pure ideas, timeless blueprints for everything that is able to take form. And you have that here in the middle of the chart. That's the IYNX or the Isis figure that represents that archetypal sphere. Then you have the intellectual sphere, the domain of divine intelligences who contemplate and draw life from the archetypes. And that's represented by this green area all through the central panel. Then you have the sidereal sphere, keep doing that. The realm of stars, planets, and cosmic forces, where intellectual patterns are translated into celestial influences, as represented by the upper panel. And then finally, you have the elemental sphere, the material world of the four elements, our physical plane, which receives the imprint of all the higher spheres. And that, of course, is here in the lower register of the Mensa Isiaka. We then explored each of these levels, beginning with the archetypal, represented by the central figure who personifies a realm of pure ideas and timeless blueprints for both the noumenal substance and living energy from which all forms, all life streams, and phenomena arise. It's really the divine source of the place where spirit and substance come together. The divine idea underlying all things, as well as the living energy which lives at the core of all sentient life. So all that is represented by this figure. Okay, the next level down, called the intellectual sphere, is made up of nine emanations in groups of three, which are called the Ophionic. That's the center one here, which is the serpents and the sphinx-like creature, which is whose element is fire. The Ibymorphis, which is this watery triad. The Nephtian, which represents air. And then finally, well, that's it for this group. That's the nine emanations. The first three emanations, Ophionic, form the vital and fiery ethereal realm, the initial intellectual world called by Robert Fludd the Ethereum. The second tier, see, this is the first tier I got off register there. So this is the Ophionic triad, the representing fire. The second tier emanation sent forth by the Ibymorphis triad are responsible for the intermediate domain of subtle forms where archetypal patterns begin to take shape. And finally, the last three emanations in this group of nine, at least, called the Nephtian triad, represent the lower ethers, which are the direct cause of formative generation. They're responsible for life on the lower planes. MPH then compares these central triads to the Sephira of the Kabbalah's Tree of Life. And you can see the correspondence here. And next we studied this passage, quote, "The table demonstrates that all is in God and God is in all. That all is in all and each is in each." In other words, a complete interpenetration. In the intellectual world are invisible spiritual counterparts of the creatures which inhabit the elemental world. So the phrase, all is in all, you see, all is in God and God is in all, echoes the Hermetic tradition of divine immanence. The supreme source permeates every level of being, yet remains infinitely greater than its creation. As Michael Robbins used to say, compared to the absolute, even the greatest of manifested beings is an infinitesimal. Yet the tablet portrays God not as a distant monarch, but as the very essence of all forms. The phrase, all is in all and each is in each, suggests that every part of the cosmos reflects and contains every other part. This isn't just a poetic idea, but it's really a blueprint for cosmic unity. Each symbol on the table is a mirror of every other symbol, inviting the seeker to see the whole in every detail. The intellectual world refers to the realm of archetypal ideas or spiritual prototypes. Here live the true patterns, whether they be animals, rivers, stars, or gods. The elemental world is our material plane where these prototypes cast their influence onto the forms of dense physical manifestation. Next, we learned that the Chaldeans and Egyptians also held that everything which is a result dwells in the cause of itself and turns to that cause as the lotus to the sun. This is actually a very beautiful idea. It's a description of the principle of immanent cause, wherein every effect or outcome already exists in potential within its originating sources. The ancients worked out these ideas going way, way back millennia before Christ. When MPH says a result dwells in the cause itself, he points to the idea that no phenomena emerges out of nothing, for each manifestation is a flowering of that which is contained in its own root source. We then took a look at a Proclus quote, which states, "Every property of divinity permeates all creation and gives itself to all inferior creatures. One of the manifestations of the Supreme Mind is the power of reproduction according to species, which it confers upon every creature of which it is the divine part." So here, Proclus confirms the same perspective we've been talking about, that the attributes we associate with divinity, like goodness, intelligence, creativity, aren't locked away in some distant realm, but rather are part of an energetic interactivity that infuses every level of cosmos. All sentient life shines with these qualities because nothing can exist without both partaking of and emanating the life aspect. Proclus' statement on the power of reproduction underscores the fact that there is a divine source for the generative impulse in nature. Every species, oak trees, horses, humans, continues itself faithfully because the divine blueprint within it contains the template for its own likeness. We've been studying that actually in the Secret Doctrine. There's a little synchronicity going on here. It's exactly the subject of the last Secret Doctrine session. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. So to start this session, we once again turn to the central figure of the Mensa-Issi-Akha, the INX or Isis principle, which symbolizes the magical, attractive power of the world soul, the principle of cohesion and love that binds the cosmos together. That's why it stands at the center of the chart. It's the cohesive force, which is a quality of the second ray. Okay, so could we get a reader, please, for this section?
Sure, I'll start it off. I apologize now for butchering any of the words. Kircher writes, "The throne denotes the diffusion of the triform supreme mind along the universal paths of the three worlds. Out of these three intangible spheres emerges the sensible universe, which Plutarch calls the house of horns, and the Egyptians the great gate of the gods. The top of the throne is in the midst of diffused serpent-shaped flames, indicating that the supreme mind is filled with light and life, eternal and incorruptible, removed from all material contact. How the supreme mind communicated his fire to all creatures is clearly set forth in the symbolism of the table. The divine fire is communicated to lower spheres through the universal power of nature personified by the world virgin, Isis, here denominated the INX, or the polymorphous all-containing universal idea. The word idea is here used in its Platonic sense. Plato believed that there are eternal forms of all possible things which exist without matter, and to these eternal and immaterial forms, he gave the name of ideas. In the Platonic sense, ideas were the patterns according to which the deity fashioned the phenomenal or typical world. Persher describes the 21 figures in the central panel thus: seven principal triads, corresponding to seven superior worlds, are shown in the central section of the table. They all originate from the fiery, invisible archetype, Triple Crown of Throne. The first, the Ophionic, or Ynx triad, VSW, corresponds to the vital and the fiery world and is the first intellectual world, called by the ancients the Ethereum. Zoroaster says of it, "Oh, what rigorous rulers this world has." The second, or Ibiomorphous triad, OQR, corresponds to the second intellectual or ethereal world and is concerned with the principle of humidity. The third, or Naphtian triad, XYZ, corresponds to the third intellectual and ethereal world and is concerned with fecundity.
Thank you, BL. Okay, so first, Kirscher writes, "The throne denotes the diffusion of the Triform Supreme Mind along the universal paths of the three worlds. Out of these three intangible spheres emerges the sensible universe, which Plutarch calls the House of Horns, and the Egyptians the Great Gate of the Gods." So by the term the throne, does Kircher mean the literal throne? You know, as he writes, the throne denotes the diffusion of the Triform Supreme Mind. So does he mean the literal throne or the central figure herself? Actually, in both cases, the definition that follows holds. As indicated by the symbol surrounding her, the central figure channels pure spirit into, and the symbols being these serpentine, Ophionic, and then the Sphinx represent they represent the channeling of pure spirit through the element of fire into the various realms represented in the chart, much like the central point of a circle. We see a similar meaning in the shape of the throne, with the vertical section representing the higher tangible realm and the horizontal axis representing the sensible world. Their meeting point implies a third dimension, depth, which corresponds to the soul world, the mediating sphere. Thus, the throne represents pretty much the same threefold axis, representing the three worlds over which the central figure holds. So it's like a physical symbol of the Isis figure that her throne is. The horns in Plutarch's House of Horns are purely symbolic and metaphysical. In his book on Isis and Osiris, Plutarch describes bull horns as conduits through which ideal forms descend from the intelligible realm into material existence. So I love that. It's the horns are the means by which ideal forms descend from the intelligible realms into material existence. So, you know, they literally are like antenna, able to receive these higher potencies and bring them into material existence. This is in perfect keeping with the role of the Ynx as put forth by Kircher. As to the Egyptian Great gate of the gods described by MPH, there is no singular gate, but rather seven distinct gateways, which are passed through by the deceased, connecting the realm of the living with the duat or afterlife, and ultimately with the fields of Anru, each gate with its own title, function, and divine custodian. I always loved this idea and this particular sculpture, which you can find at Karnak Temple. Okay, next. By the way, it's always more interesting to have a dialogue than a monologue. So, if any, oops. Hello, Michael. If there's any, if you have any questions or thoughts at all, please raise your hand. We get a little dialogue going here. Okay. So next, the top of the throne is in the midst of diffused serpent-shaped flames, indicating that the supreme mind is filled with light and life, eternal and incorruptible, removed from all material contact. So here are the diffused serpent-shaped flames at the very top of the Isean throne, which appear, which actually reminds me of the Logoic or Uti plane, called by DK the Sea of Fire. Both seem to inform that which is below, them. Here you have these winged globes, which might relate to the monadic and atmic planes, before the Buddhic reality of Isis, represented by this. Of course, that's just an hypothesis about, what might be symbolized. I can't start my video because it is disabled by the host. BL?
Yeah, how come you can't do the Oh, I'm sorry. My
Sorry.
bad.
There we go. Thank you. Okay. All righty. So next, the end of Kircher's quote. How the supreme mind communicated his fire to all creatures is clearly set forth in the symbolism of the table. The divine fire is communicated to lower spheres through the universal power of nature, personified by the world virgin Isis, here dominated the oh no, denominated the IYNX, or the, and this is what IYNX means, the polymorphous, all-containing universal idea. So the supreme mind is the unmanifest source of all being, the initiating divine intellect on the cosmic mental plane. Okay. Its fire is the living energy or creative impulse that sparks every level of existence. We have the same idea in theosophy with the cosmic mental plane initiating all physical activity and the will to be is instigated, and the beings, Deific and Logoic beings, come into form in order to create the material world. Isis, called here the World Virgin, embodies nature's universal power. As IYNX, the quote, transmitting intelligence or polymorphous universal idea, she stands at the nexus between pure mind and the manifested realms. And there, acting as the all-containing matrix, the lens, as it were, that transforms unity into diversity. So, we've been studying this for a while now. I hope you're starting to get some sense of how this chart unfolds. This is a key idea. Actually, I like this figure, which is really a figure of Hathor aspect of Isis, certainly more artistically created than this figure. Next, the word idea is here used in its Platonic sense. Plato believed that there are eternal forms of all possible things which exist without matter. And to these eternal and material forms, he gave the name ideas. In the Platonic sense, ideas were the patterns according to which deity fashioned the phenomenal world, which he called ectypal. In this context, the term idea refers not so much to a mental process as to Pluto's immaterial forms, which are timeless, absolute, and unchanging essences that exist independently of the physical world. In Platonic philosophy, forms, capitalized to denote their ideal nature, are perfect and complete in themselves. They serve as archetypal blueprints for all that manifests in the dense physical world, which Plato refers to as ectypes. These material copies derive their structure from the realm of true forms, yet they remain vulnerable to the imperfections and transience inherent in physical existence. So MPH is here citing Sir William Hamilton's lectures on metaphysics published in 1860. Next, Kircher describes the 21 figures in the central panel thus: seven principal triads corresponding to seven superior worlds are shown in the central section of the table. They all originate from the fiery, invisible archetype, the triple crown of the throne. So, a quick review. Each of the seven triads in the central panel symbolizes one of the seven superior worlds, or heavens above the material planes, which are specific articulations of the central threefold IYNX, specific articulations of this, of the great idea personified by the IYNX, which is the seventh or synthesizing principle, counting from below upwards. Next, the first, the Ophionic or IYNX triad, corresponds to the vital and fiery world and is the first intellectual world, called by the ancients the Ethereum. Zoroaster says of it, "Oh, what rigorous rulers this world has." So this is that group. It's comprised of a central figure flanked by two serpents, forming a triad that embodies the vital and fiery world. This realm, the first intellectual sphere beyond pure matter, was called the Ethereum by the ancients, that subtle element that fills celestial space. And finally, the second, or Ibimorphous triad, corresponds to the second intellectual or ethereal world and is concerned with the principle of humidity. The third, or Nephthian triad, corresponds to the third intellectual and ethereal world and is concerned with fecundity. Okay, so the Ibimorphous triad, by the way, I found, since last time, I found another source of these illustrations in this old book by Pignorius. I found it online. Much better detail, but it was incomplete, or I would be using it exclusively. But they did have a great shot of this triad. Anyway, so the Ibimorphous triad represents a transitional realm where pure fire cools into moisture. So, initially, you just have two elements. You have fire, which is pure spirit, and you have moisture, which represents the physical realms, but strictly at an archetypal level, right? As yet, there are no other elements. According to Kircher, its three figures embody the three aspects of this moisture principle: generation of subtle aerial currents, distribution of life-giving water, and harmony of condensation and evaporation. These are a little beyond our pay grade. You have to do a deep dive to get the specific meaning of each of these ideas. Some of them are connected with alchemy. The Nephthian triad, and I didn't have, you can see how much better this illustration is than this, but I couldn't find the equivalent for the Nephthian, so we're stuck with this one. The Nephthian triad represents that stage of becoming where moisture and fire unite. So it's a third level, right? Fire, then moisture, and then here, the combination. They unite to spark creation. The term Nephthian suggests clouds and generative forces, akin to the Greek nephos, which means cloud, or the Egyptian Nephthys, a goddess associated with Isis, who was a life-giving goddess. According to Kircher, this realm is the seedbed of multiplication. Plants germinate, animals reproduce, and all forms diversify. Its figures represent three facets of fecundity: burgeoning or vegetal and animal life, cycles of birth, growth, and renewal, and proliferation of forms in harmony with their archetypes. Any thoughts or questions? Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
There are the three triads of the ethereal worlds, which correspond to the Father Foundation. Then follow the four triads of the sensible or material worlds, of which the first two correspond to the sidereal worlds, G, I, K, and I'm not going to try, namely Osiris and Isis, sun and moon, indicated by two bulls. They are followed by the two triads, the Hecatine, LMN, and the Sera Pan. Again, I'm skipping, corresponding to the sublunary and subterranean worlds. These complete the seven worlds of primary Geni, ruling the natural universe. Psellus quotes Zoroaster. The Egyptians and the Chaldeans taught that there were seven corporeal worlds, i.e., worlds ruled by the intellectual powers. The first is of pure fire, the second, third, and fourth ethereal, the fifth, sixth, and seventh material, the seventh being the one called terrestrial and hater of light and is located under the moon, comprising within itself the matter called fundus or foundation. These seven, plus the one invisible crown, constitute the eight worlds. Plato writes that it is needful for the philosopher to know how the seven circles beneath the first one are arranged according to the Egyptians. The first triad of fire denotes life, the second, water, over which rule the ibimorphous divinities, and the third, air, ruled by Nephta. From the fire, the heavens were created, from the water, the earth and air was the mediator between them. In the Sefer Yetzirah, it is said that from the three originate the seven, i.e., the height, the depth, the east, the west, the north, and the south, and the holy temple in the center, sustaining them all. Is not the holy temple in the center the great throne of the many-formed spirit of nature, which is shown in the middle of the tablet? What are the seven triads but the seven powers that rule over the world?
Thank you. Okay, hang on, just taking care of something. All right. Okay. So, first. These are the three triads of the ethereal worlds, which correspond to the Father Foundation. So the three triads in the central panel represent fire, which sparks the first articulation of divine will, moisture, which tempers the fiery seed into receptive substance and provides the medium through which life's patterns will flow, and fecundity, which activates proliferation. Together, they form a threefold, what Kircher calls paternal foundation, where will, substance, and generation converge into the first living matrix. Next, then follows the four triads of the sensible or material worlds, of which the first two correspond to the sidereal worlds, G, I, and K, and gamma, delta, and epsilon, namely Osiris and Isis, sun and moon, indicated by two bulls. Okay. Translation, the Issiac triad at left is lunar, as indicated by the black and white bull named Apis, representing the new and full moons. The Osirian or Assyrian triad at right is solar, as indicated by the white bull whose name is Mnevis. Next, they are followed by two triads, the Hecatean, L-M and N, and the Serapian, Zeta, Eta, and Theta, corresponding to the sublunary and subterranean world. So whereas the stellar principles, Osiris and Isis, flood down from the heavens, the sublunary forces, represented by the Hecatean and Serapian triads, animate the living world's constant change and drive the hidden alchemy of death and renewal. And they're definitely connected, these two and these two. You could say they're the source and receptive aspect of the lunar and solar principles. Next, these complete the seven worlds of primary genii ruling the natural universe, which makes up the central panel of the Mensa Issiaca. So you have the Iengian or the Ophionian, that's this number one, the central, then the Ibimorphic, the world of moisture, and it's ethereal, the Nephtian, world of fecundity, the Issiac, world of the moon, which is sidereal, Assyrian, world of the sun, which is sidereal, Hecatine, world of vegetable growth, sublunar, informed by the lunar, and Serapian, world of subterranean existences, informed by the Osirian, you know, who journeys in the underworld, but bringing the solar principle to that underworld. Okay. Next, Celis quotes Zoroaster. The Egyptians and the Chaldeans taught that there were seven corporeal worlds, that is, worlds ruled by the intellectual powers. The first is pure fire. The second, third, and fourth, ethereal. The fifth, sixth, and seventh, material. The seventh being the one called a terrestrial and, quote, hater of light, and is located under the moon, comprising within itself the matter called fundus or foundation. Okay, so Celis, Mira, she's like 11th century writer, Platonist. He mirrors Zoroaster's teaching that the macrocosm is divided into seven corporeal realms. This is also theosophical ideas, each governed by distinct powers. These worlds are not merely spatial layers, but levels of being, from the most refined fire to the densest matter. Could we get a reader for this? The nature of these worlds, please.
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
First world, pure fire, a realm of unalloyed spirit and primordial energy, akin to the hearth of creation. Second, third, fourth worlds, ethereal, zones of subtle air and light where souls and intelligences intermingle. Fifth, sixth worlds, transitional matter, increasingly corporeal spheres that bridge ethereal forces, the solid form. Seventh world, terrestrial, the heaviest material domain under the moon, hostile to light and inhabited by matter, called fundus or foundation.
Thank you. Okay. Next, these seven plus the one invisible crown constitute the eight worlds. So the invisible crown stands above and beyond the seven corporeal worlds. It is not a spatial sphere, but a transcendent principle that crowns the entire cosmic edifice, where the seven worlds represent successive gradations of form and limitation. The eighth is pure, unmanifested potential, light without shadow, unity without duality. Obviously, MPH is citing this quote from Celis to show a relationship between the seven corporeal worlds and the central panel of the Mensa Issiaca, with the crown of the IYNX, right? So these represent the corporeal, and IYNX represents the invisible crown of Celis. Next, Plato writes that it is needful for the philosopher to know how the seven circles beneath the first are arranged according to the Egyptians. In the Timaeus, Plato alludes to an ancient tradition originating, he claims, in the temples of Sais, where priests expounded on the ordering of the heavens beneath the highest sphere. Plato's seven circles beneath the first one corresponds to the classical planetary spheres that carry the fixed stars on the primo mobile. In descending order from the outermost to the nearest, they are Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, the Sun, Venus, Mercury, and the Moon. Each sphere governs its own domain of time, rhythm, and influence. Mastery of their arrangement was considered essential for any philosopher seeking an integrated vision of the cosmos. So they're not just the planets. These are stages of being, stages of becoming, that the ancients associated with these planetary spheres. The Master DK, through Alice Bailey, has codified this idea into a more modern understanding through the idea of the sacred planets and the esoteric rulers, which allows you to participate in the higher forms of these planetary energies. Any thoughts or questions? Okay. Next, MPH returns to the central panel. The first triad of fire denotes life, the second water, of which rules the Ibamorphous divinities, and the third air, ruled by Nephta. From the fire, the heavens were created. From the water, the earth, and air was a mediator between them. So here, MPH links the three primary triads, fire, earth, and air, as the mediating agency between heaven and earth. Next, in the Sefira Yetzirah, it is said that from the three originated the seven, that is, the height, the depth, the east, the west, the north, and the south, and the holy temple in the center, sustaining them all. So the Sefer Yetzirah teaches that from the three mother letters, Aleph, Mem, and Shin, originate the seven double letters, which map onto the six cardinal directions, plus a central point, right? These seven are height, depth, east, west, north, and south, with the holy temple positioned at the exact center to sustain and harmonize them all. It's like a three-dimensional point in the center of the circle. Next, is not the holy temple in the center of the great throne of the many-formed spirit of nature, which is shown in the middle of the tablet? What are the seven triads but the seven powers that rule over the world? Okay, the holy temple at the very center of the Isiac tablet is the world soul's throne, the sacred heart where the many-formed spirit of nature manifests in unity. Encircling it are seven groups of three figures, seven triads, each one a triplet of divine aspects. These represent the seven ruling powers of the cosmos, each triad representing an elemental force in its generative, sustaining, and reconciling modes. Okay, before we turn the page, let's take a look at the illustration and accompanying text at the center of the page, entitled Westcott's Key to the Bimbine Table. As you can see in this overlay, the illustration names the 15 regions of the Mensa Isiaca and gives the identifying letters for the main characters that are described in Westcott's book, the Isiac Tablet. It's useful for determining which letter goes with which figure. Can we get a reader, please, for this description?
Yes, let me see who's left. And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
One moment. Oh, okay. Now I'm seeing the whole. Zoroastra declared that the number three shines through the world. This is revealed in the Bambine table by a series of triads representing the creative impulses. Of the Isiaca table, Alexandre Lenoir writes, "The Isiac table is a work of art, is not of great interest. It is but a composition, rather cold and insignificant, whose figures summarily sketched and methodically placed near each other give but little impression of life. But if on the contrary, after examining, we understand the purpose of the author, we become soon convinced that the Isiac table is an image of a heavenly sphere divided in small parts to be used very likely for general teaching. According to the idea, we can conclude that the Isiac table was originally the introduction to a collection followed by the Mysteries of Isis. It was engraved on a copper in order to be used in the ceremonial of initiation. See? New essay on the Isiac table. Do you want me to read here?
No, it's the same thing. I just took this and made it more readable over here. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Hi, Veronica. So first, Zoroaster declared that the number three shines throughout the world. This is revealed in the Bimbine table by a series of triads representing the creative impulses. Yes, indeed, the whole thing is built around triads. So, in Zoroaster's original teaching, the divine manifests in triads. For example, the three good, quote unquote, principles, good thought, good word, and good deed. Zoroaster also taught about the three aspects of Ahura Mazda, which was the god, the Babylonian god, which are essence, light, and life. You can see how advanced this spirituality was. And finally, by saying three shines throughout the world, Zoroaster means that every act of creation and every law of nature unfolds in three stages. Inception, you know, it's sent forth. There's a time of mediation. And finally, which is the entire life cycle. And then finally, consummation. Much like the Hindu Trimurti, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, which mirror creation, preservation, and destruction. In similar fashion, the Mensa Ithiaka has in the IYNX an active generative triad, a lunar or reflective principle in the Ibimorphic triad, and a harmonizing principle in the Nephthian triad. Okay, next on the Isiac table, Alexandre Lenoir writes, "The Isiac table as a work of art is not of great interest. It is but a composition, rather cold and insignificant, whose figures, summarily sketched and methodically placed near each other, give but little impression of life." Yeah, true enough, the Mensa Ithiaka is not an aesthetically inspired creation, but notice that he says, whose figures summarily sketched but methodically placed. So the purpose of the tablet was not to create a great piece of art, but to create a teaching tool that would reveal the spiritual nature of cosmos on many levels. In fact, we're coming to a section where MPH explores the many ways in which this tablet can be used, besides what Kircher gave out. So let's continue. "But if, on the contrary, after examining it, we understand the purpose of the author, we become soon convinced that the Isiac table is an image of the heavenly sphere, divided in small parts to be used very likely for general teaching." Exactly. So Lenoir suggests the table was not chiefly made to amaze by its artistry, but more as a tool for instruction on the cosmic architecture, which guided both Roman devotees of Isis as well as later Western esoteric traditions like Kircher and Levi. Next. "According to that idea, we can conclude that the Isiac table was originally the introduction to a collection followed by the mysteries of Isis. It was engraved on copper in order to be used in the ceremonial of initiation." See new essay on the Isiac table. So the table might have been used to outline certain mythic and cosmological themes for new initiates in a Roman school based on the mysteries of Isis, with each symbol corresponding to a lesson or ritual act in those mysteries. This is speculation, but I think very possible. New essay on the Isiac table is written by Alexandre Lenoir, who we've been quoting from back in 1809. So, you know, this has been the subject of people's interest for centuries. Okay, next up, back to the text, where we turn to page 60. In the folio edition, could we get a reader, please? Oops.
Sure. Uh-oh. Celis writes, the Egyptians worshipped the triad of faith, truth, and love. In the seven fountains, the sun is ruler, the fountain of matter, then the fountain of the archangels, the fountain of the senses, of judgment, of lightning, of reflections, and of characters of unknown composition. They say that the highest material fountains are those of Apollo, Osiris, and Mercury, the fountains of the centers of the elements. Thus, they understood by the sun as ruler the solar world, by the material archangelic, the lunar world, and by the fountain of the senses, the world of Saturn, by judgment, Jupiter, by lightning, Mars, by that of the reflections or mirrors, the world of Venus, by the fountain of characters, the world of Mercury. All these are shown by the figures in the center pane of the tablet. The upper panel contains the 12 figures of the zodiac arranged in four triads. The center figure in each group represents one of the four fixed signs of the zodiac. S is the sign of Aquarius, Z, Taurus, C, Leo, and G, Scorpio. These are called the fathers. In the secret teaching of the Far East, these four figures, the man, bull, the lion, and the eagle, are called the winged globe, or the four Maharajas who stand upon the corners of creation. The four cardinal signs, P, Capricorn, X, Aries, B, Cancer, F, Libra, are called the powers. The four
Yeah, you don't have to read that letters at this point.
Oh, okay.
They're meaningless.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Four common signs, Pisces, Gemini, Virgo, Sagittarius, were called the minds of the four lords. This explains the meaning of the winged globes of Egypt and the four central figures, Aquarius, Taurus, Leo, and Scorpio, called by Ezekiel the Cherubim, are the globes. The cardinal and common signs on either side are the wings. Therefore, the 12 signs of the zodiac may be symbolized by four globes with two wings.
Thank you, PL. Okay. First, Celis writes, the Egyptians worshiped the triad of faith, truth, and love, and the seven fountains. The sun is ruler, the fountain of matter, then the fountain of the archangels, the fountain of the senses, of judgment, of lightning, of reflections, and of characters of unknown composition. So Michael, or Mikael, Celis, was an 11th century Byzantine philosopher who wrote a commentary on the Chaldean oracles. These oracles were a body of mystical texts attributed to Zoroaster, but actually composed by Platonists, right? They weren't, this happened a lot, where it would be attributed to, you know, a great past avatar like Zoroaster, but in fact were written by Platonists or Neoplatonists. As to Celis's statement, there is no Egyptian triad. As to Celis's statement, there is no Egyptian triad representing faith, truth, and love, standing as the source of a hierarchy of gods, which he implies here. He says the Egyptians worshipped the triad of faith, truth, and love. Okay. However, these qualities are exemplified by certain Egyptian deities. For example, Maat embodies truth and cosmic order, Heka, spiritual trust or faith, and Hathor love beauty and music, but you don't see them linked together like you see, for instance, Isis, Osiris, and Horus as a specific triad, right? But in Salus's schema, this triad of qualities is the source of all subsequent powers, ensuring that every fountain of force flows through the lens of these core values. These seven, quote unquote, fountains channel distinct cosmic energies into the manifest world, with each fountain corresponding to both a planet and to a stage of spiritual development. Okay, so next up, they say that the highest material fountains are those of Apollo, Osiris, and Mercury, the fountains of the centers of the elements. Thus, they understood by the sun as ruler of the solar world, by the material archangelic, the lunar world, by the fountain of the senses, the world of Saturn, by judgment, Jupiter, by lightning, Mars, by that of the reflections or mirrors, the world of Venus, by the fountains of characters, the world of Mercury. All these are shown by the figures in the center pane of the tablet. Salus maps each fountain onto one of the seven planetary orbs depicted in the central pane of the tablet. Together, they chart a layered cosmos in which spirit and matter move through a sequence of ruling powers. So these are the fountains just described by a man like P. Hall, right? The sun, the archangels, the senses, judgment, et cetera, right? And the Celis's description, the planet they're related to, and the notes on this or ideas connected with this. We won't go through these. If you're interested, you can go to hermetic.com, an absolutely fabulous site where you can find this type of info. Okay. Next, the upper panel contains the 12 figures of the zodiac arranged in four triads. The center figure in each group represents one of the four fixed signs of the zodiac. I have to apologize for the repetition. It's not my repetition, it's Manly P. Hall's. But in his defense, I will say that each time he repeats, he is bringing another point forward about that particular group. We've studied these right here, the four, the upper register, which we just explored, in detail in previous sessions. But he's setting us up for a further teaching about these. If you remember, these are the zodiacal signs with the fixed sign represented by the central figure in each case. Okay, next. In the secret teachings of the Far East, these four figures, the man, the bull, the lion, and the eagle, are called the winged globes, or the four Maharajas who stand upon the corners of creation. So this is the further teaching that he's giving us about these fixed signs. The statement connects to the previous passage by the fact that the central figure in each of the upper panel triads represents a fixed sign of the zodiac, as do the four figures of the tetramorph, is what these guys are called. A symbol of cosmic unity, revealing that the logos speaks in four voices, but with one unified intent. Next, the four cardinal signs, Capricorn, Aries, Cancer, Libra, are called the powers. So the cardinal signs mark the four pivotal points of the solstices and equinoxes, thereby indicating where and when divine will penetrates the zodiac in order to initiate a new cycle. Next, the four common signs, Pisces, Gemini, Virgo, and Sagittarius, are called the minds of the four lords. For MPH, the mutable signs are seen as the minds of the four cardinal powers. They serve as the intellect that interprets, much like Bina in the Tree of Life, in the Sephiroth, the Bina or third Sephiroth. The intellect that interprets, adapts, and refines the raw creative impulse delivered by the cardinal lords, thus transforming an initiative into flexible, thoughtful action. That's why they're called, that's why they're related to the mutable signs. And finally, this explains the meaning of the winged globes of Egypt for the four central figures, Aquarius, Taurus, Leo, and Scorpio, called by Ezekiel the cherubim, are the globes. The cardinal and common signs on either side are the wings. Therefore, the 12 signs of the zodiac may be symbolized by four globes, each with two wings. This is just, realize this is pure Manly Hall idea, right? In his schema, the four globes symbolize the constancy and stability of each season's core quality, with the wings representing the transitional energies that both launch and interpret that quality. But this was not the meaning of the solar disk in ancient Egypt, whereas Ra Horus, it symbolized divine presence and royal protection. Nonetheless, it is an apt symbol for the three aspects of the four zodiacal triads. The winged globe appears throughout the Mensa Isiaca and can be seen both above and below the IYNX. Here, I think it actually does represent divine presence and protection. Okay, how are we doing? Let's see. We've got a little while yet to go. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
The celestial triads are further shown by the Egyptians as a globe, the father, from which issue a serpent, the mind, and wings, the power. These 12 forces are the fabricators of the world, and from them emanate the microcosm, or the mystery of the 12 sacred animals, representing in the universe the 12 parts of the world, and in man, the 12 parts of the human body. Anatomically, the 12 figures in the upper panel may well symbolize the 12 convolutions of the brain, and the 12 figures in the lower panel, the 12 zodiacal members and organs of the human body. For man is a creature formed of the 12 sacred animals, with his members and organs and the direct control of the 12 governors or powers resident in the brain. A more profound interpretation is found in the correspondences between the 12 figures in the upper panel and the 12 in the lower. This furnishes a key to one of the most arcane of ancient secrets, the relationship existing between the two great zodiacs, the fixed and the movable. The fixed zodiac is described as an immense dodecahedron, its 12 surfaces representing the outermost walls of abstract space. From each surface of this dodecahedron, a great spiritual power radiating inward becomes embodied as one of the hierarchies of the movable zodiac, which is a band of circumambulating
so-called fixed stars. Within this movable zodiac are posited the various planetary and elemental bodies. The relation of these two zodiacs to the zodiacal spheres has a correlation in the respiratory system of the human body. The great fixed zodiac may be said to represent the atmosphere, the movable zodiac, the lungs, and the sub-zodiacal worlds, the body.
Thank you. Okay, first, the celestial triads are further shown by the Egyptian as a globe, the father, from which issue a serpent, the mind, and wings, the power. So Hall elaborates on his use of the winged globe as a symbol. It further represents the pater, or father, the mens, or mind, and power, or potentia. In the triads of the upper register, the Mensa Isiaca, by associating the globe with the father, the serpent with the mind or mens, and the power or potentia with the wings, gives an apt analogy, even though it doesn't come directly from ancient Egypt. Nonetheless, it works, you know, the idea of the trifold quality of the winged globe works very well, actually, not just because there are three, but by the very nature of the qualities of the winged globe compared to the qualities of these four triads. Okay, next, these 12 forces are the fabricators of the world, and from them emanate the microcosm, or the mystery of the 12 sacred animals, representing in the universe the 12 parts of the world, and in man the 12 parts of the human body. Okay, so the 12 forces, also called the 12 governors, are the potencies, that's that upper row, right? Are the potency of the 12 zodiacal signs, each of which have their own energy patterns that shape both consciousness and form. By analogical magic, ancient physicians and mystics mapped each animal force to a region of the body. You know, this is traditional astrology, right? Aries, the head, Taurus, the heart, Gemini, the arms, down through Pisces, which rules the feet. This anatomical schema reflects the belief that human health and temperament are direct expression of cosmic rhythms. In ritual or healing, ancient healers invoke the appropriate sacred animal or its ruling force to restore harmony to that body part and its corresponding life field. Now, this is a understanding of astrological forces that the Master DK also puts forward. For instance, in his section on Taurus, he talks a lot about the connection of the Taurus energy field with the neck and the throat center, right? So this is a very real thing. Okay, next up. Anatomically, the 12 figures in the upper panel may well symbolize the 12 convolutions of the brain and the 12 figures in the lower panel, the 12 zodiacal members and organs of the human body. For man is a creature formed of the 12 sacred animals with his members and organs under the direct control of the 12 governors or powers resident in the brain. So the idea of 12 convolutions of the brain didn't actually appear until the Renaissance and is thus more an interpretive construct than any reflection of real ancient Egyptian design or an anatomical science. However, though modern science only recognizes four divisions of the cerebral cortex, it does recognize 12 pairs of cranial nerves. Who knows? Maybe these 12 have an occult association with the signs. Or maybe there are subtle regions of the brain that are not as yet mapped by modern science that, in fact, correlate with the 12 signs. Next, a more profound interpretation is found in the correspondence between the 12 figures in the upper panel and the 12 in the lower. This furnishes a key to one of the most arcane of ancient secrets, the relationship existing between the two great zodiacs of the fixed and the movable. So this is a whole departure from what he's been talking about, said undue teaching. First, the quote unquote fixed zodiac is based on the unchanging position of the constellations, whereas the movable zodiac divides the year into 12 equal signs, each tied to a seasonal phase beginning with 0 degrees of Aries in the spring. This zodiac is movable, quote unquote, because its starting point, the equinox, is tied to the Earth's orientation, not to any fixed stars or constellation. The slow drift of the two zodiacs against each other, called the precession of the equinoxes, generates the world ages. So the upper panel of 12 figures represents the constellations, the fixed stellar archetypes, whereas the lower panel represents how these higher archetypes flow into the sublunar world by governing the seasons as the solstices and equinox points slide through the constellations. Reading one row across to the other, or down to the other, reveals how each movable sign is the earthly phase of its eternal celestial counterpart. So you're beginning to see how many relationships are indicated in this Mensa Isiaca. Next, the fixed zodiac is described as an immense dodecahedron. It's 12 surfaces representing the outermost wall of abstract space. From each surface of this dodecahedron, a great spiritual power radiating inward becomes embodied as one of the hierarchies of the movable zodiac, which is a band of circumambulating so-called fixed stars. Okay, so in this model of the heavens, I couldn't find one in English, but you can see it here. Each face of the dodecahedron, that's this figure here, that's five-sided figure times 12, corresponds to one of the 12 signs of the fixed zodiac, not just as constellations, but as cosmic archetypes or great spiritual potencies, which is really what the constellations are. In this model, the 12 surfaces form the outermost walls of abstract space, a metaphysical boundary beyond which lies pure, undifferentiated spirit. From each face of the dodecahedron, a spiritual power radiates inward, meaning that the eternal archetype sends its energy into the realms of creation. These powers become embodied as hierarchies, as spiritual intelligences or forces that govern the movable zodiac, what we call the signs, right? Which is the seasonal earth-centered zodiac we experience in time and space. Finally, so that's, the idea is to give a sense of how the higher zodiac is related to the movable zodiac. Okay, finally, within this movable zodiac are posited the various planetary and elemental bodies, the relation of these two zodiacs to the sub-zodiacal spheres, that's the physical realms, has a correlation in the respiratory system of the human body. The great fixed zodiac may be said to represent the atmosphere, the movable zodiac, the lungs, and the sub-zodiacal worlds, the body. This is MPH. Really, MPH is interpretive ability at its best. So we have the fixed zodiac tied to the constellations, representing the unchanging spiritual matrix, the archetypal ether from which all forms emanate. Just as the atmosphere holds the potential for breath, the fixed zodiac holds the potential for manifestation. Continuing with the metaphor, the movable zodiac, which shifts with the seasons and precesses over time, is like the lungs, constantly moving, expanding and contracting. The lungs take in the atmosphere of the fixed zodiac and translate it into life force, just as the movable zodiac translates each eternal archetypes into temporal experience. Finally, the quote-unquote sub-zodiacal worlds or form aspect, including the human body, receives the breath, is shaped by it, and lives through it. In this model, the body is the final expression of cosmic rhythm governed by the interplay of the fixed and movable zodiacal forces. Okay, any thoughts or questions? Okay. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Did you say me?
Yes. Yes, please.
The spiritual atmosphere containing the vivifying energies of the 12 divine powers of the great fixed zodiac is inhaled by the cosmic lungs, the movable zodiac, and distributed by them through the constitution of the 12 holy animals, which are the parts and members of the material universe. The functional cycle is completed when the poisonous effluvia of the lower worlds collected by the movable zodiac are exhaled into the great fixed zodiac, there to be purified by being passed through the divine natures of its 12 internal hierarchies. The table as a whole is susceptible of many interpretations. If the board of the table with its hieroglyphs figures be accepted as the spiritual source, then the throne in the center represents the physical body within which human nature is enthroned. From this point of view, the entire table becomes emblematic of the auric bodies of men, with the borders as the outer extremity or shell of the auric egg. If the throne be accepted as the symbol of the spiritual sphere, the border typifies the elements, and the various panels surrounding the central one becomes emblematic of the worlds or planes emanating from the one divine source. If the table be considered from a purely physical basis, the throne becomes symbolic of the generative system, and the table reveals the secret processes of embryology as applied to the formation of the material worlds. If a purely philosophical and anatomical interpretation be desired, the central throne becomes the heart, the ebimorphous triad, the mind, the Nephthian triad, the generative system, and the surrounding hieroglyphs, the various parts and members of the human body. From the evolutionary viewpoint, the central gate becomes the point of both entrance and exit. Here also is set forth the process of initiation, in which the candidate, after passing successfully through the various ordeals, is finally brought into the presence of his own soul, which he alone is capable of unveiling.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Anne Veronica. A lot here. First, the spiritual atmosphere containing the vivifying energies of the 12 divine powers of the great fixed zodiac is inhaled by the cosmic lungs, the movable zodiac, and distributed by them through the constitution of the 12 holy animals, which are the parts and members of the material universe. So Hall here articulates four layers of reality by making a subtle distinction between the movable zodiac and the signs. He adds this in this part, right? So the fixed zodiac represents the constellations, source of divine archetypes and cosmic intention. Anatomically, this layer is mirrored in the atmosphere, which is the vast field of spiritual potential that surrounds and permeates all sentient life. It is from this celestial vault that the 12 divine powers radiate, each one an immutable face of cosmic truth. Descending from this source, the movable zodiac serves as the translator of those archetypes into the realm of time and space. Anchored to the equinoxes and solstices, it forms the tropical zodiac, the seasonal processor of the fixed zodiac. This layer is symbolically aligned with the lungs, which draw in the breath of the atmosphere and distribute it throughout the body. Just as the lungs transform air into life force, the movable zodiac transforms eternal archetypes into temporal experience. Within this framework, the signs, Aries through Pisces, act as the receivers and distributors of divine energy. These 12 individual energy fields channel the breath of the cosmos into specific modes of expression. Each sign governs a phase of the soul's journey, directing the flow of breath to distinct regions of the body. They are the living expressions of the zodiacal rhythm, shaping personality, physiology, and spiritual development. Finally, the sublunary worlds embody those forces in the realm of matter. This layer includes the elemental, planetary, and incarnate realms. The physical organs, instincts, emotions, and earthly conditions that make up the human body in the material universe. It corresponds anatomically to the body itself, which receives and expresses the divine breath through its form and function. Here, the archetypes become flesh, and the cosmic respiration completes its descent. Any thoughts or questions? Okay. Next, the functional cycle is completed when the poisonous effluvia of the lower worlds is collected by the movable zodiac, are exhaled into the great fixed zodiac, there to be purified by being passed through the divine natures of its 12 eternal hierarchies. It's beautiful. So just as the lungs not only inhale oxygen, but also exhale carbon dioxide, the movable zodiac, the lungs of the cosmos, collect and expel the toxic residues of incarnation, the quote-unquote poisonous effluvia of the sublunary worlds. These include emotional distortions, karmic residue, psychic pollution, all generated by life in the material realm. The result of this purificatory outbreath is restoration of cosmic balance. So you have you not only have a descent, you have an ascent from the, you know, the poisonous effluvia from the sublunary worlds going back up and being purified. So there's this constant cycling of energy that's going on, yeah, in this system. quite beautiful, actually. And I think that's a good place to stop before we get into this next paragraph. So, thank you all for making the adjustment and coming an hour later. I know for some people that's impossible. We have a smaller class today than usual. But hopefully we'll be back on schedule next month. Time announcement.
Francis?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give the time announcements in just a second. I wanted to say this, what you've just gone through the last few slides is an excellent presentation of the difference between the tropical and sidereal zodiacs.
That's
I mean,
it.
I can give the technical aspect of what the difference is and how they drift and the
Right.
fact that DK has said that the one is more factual and the other one is more esoteric.
Right.
But the way this has been described here, it explains it even more so because, you know, in astrology, we not only work with the tropical zodiac and the constellations, which DK tells us are different
Yeah.
than the actual, I mean, we work with the signs. And DK tells us that's different than the constellations.
Yeah.
One are the fixed stars, and the other are our interpretation and our meaning as the tropical goes on here. But this just really explains that in a more esoteric way than the scientific explanation of it. So.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, you get a sense of the relation between, the fixed zodiac and this, and how the signs are described. And DK, makes many times makes a point of distinguishing the two. But there's something in this part of Manly P. Hall's presentation that really makes it clearer. I love the idea of this pure atmosphere coming in, and it infuses the lower worlds with the living force, and then the poisonous effluvia, of life on the lower planes is then sent up to be purified. So you have this constant cycling. To me, that's a really beautiful thing. I see we have a question from Anne Veronica. Yes, Anne Veronica.
It's not a question, it's a request. This is very interesting, and I think that we should read the slide again and talk about it because it's 12:30. I haven't got the courage. As also, it's very interesting that you said there were 12 nerves in the brain that probably they have to do with the 12 zodiac signs.
Yeah,
So
they're here.
this is
Somewhere here.
very
Yeah, they're
interesting.
there.
And also the Greeks believed that the universe was the dodecahedron, and there are some scientists that say that the universe is a dodecahedron. So these are very interesting, and it would be
Yeah.
good to talk about them again next time.
Yeah, Plato puts forth this idea.
Yes,
This was,
Plato put forth this idea that the zodiac is a dodecahedron. And some scientists also say that our universe might be that way, the dodecahedron.
I love the philosophy that comes out of that idea, because it makes the zodiac a like an enclosing sphere, right, rather than a linear unfoldment. It's not like you go from January to February, and with it you go from Capricorn to Aquarius. Instead of that, you have this idea of all these qualities mutually working on the material plane, on those in physical incarnation. I find it energetically much more philosophically
It also
accurate.
gives a very good image of the heavenly man, the
Yeah.
higher heavenly man.
Right.
It really describes him in many ways, the lungs, the body, the coming in of the breath and all those things and how it works for us. Very interesting. I think we should talk about it again next time.
Great. Well, you know, I want to remind you that this webinar series is in trouble of disappearing, because I have to have at least 10 people besides BL and I in attendance before I can continue to
yes,
create.
But these are special circumstances.
I know today.
You cut me off because I was going to tell you I will be coming in. Please count me, but I will be coming in late.
What, next
okay.
time? Maybe? Yeah. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is that, you know, a very liberal way of doing it, which is three sequential webinars that during the webinar have no more than 10 besides, which means 12, including BL and I. Then if there's three consecutive webinars, then the series will end. I really hope that doesn't happen. I wish there was some way to get the word out, because there's stuff going on in this series that doesn't happen in either the Secret Doctrine or the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series. You know, you just, it's unique to this series. Yeah, everybody has constraints on their time, and it's maybe hard to imagine how this could be useful or important. But anyway, so, you know, what can I say? Tell your friends, because we are right at the edge on this, and I really hope that we can keep it going. Okay, dates?
All right, the next webinar is going to be your TCF webinar on Friday the 10th.
This coming Friday.
And then, yeah, this coming Friday, uh-huh. And then the Secret Doctrine on the 19th of October. So we're back on schedule for that. That'll be at 7 p.m. BMT. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages is going to be on 2 November. And that's going to revert to 8 p.m. because that's when the states go back to standard time. I believe Europe has gone back, or will go before us. But
okay, yeah. Yeah, I think we go first. They follow. But I'm not.
No, not this time. I believe they go first.
Okay. But what's important about this is to realize that your local time stays the same. That's why I...
In the States, it stays the same. And depending on when they change in Europe, it will revert back to the same time.
Yeah. You might have one or two webinars that go that are later, and then you come back at the same time. I think it's better to have it at the same time than to arbitrarily go with 7 o'clock UTC. You know, I just think it's a better way to go, because people get used to, you know, scheduling these things according to their local time frame. You know, so that's the way it's going to go. That shouldn't create too much disruption. But yeah, okay, that's it for this time. Thank you all very much for attending. I appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Francis.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, BL. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.